Chapter 9. Uncommon Amongst Uncommon. The anesthesia took hold, and I felt myself wheeling backward until I landed in a scene from my past. We were humping through the jungle in the dead of night. Our movement was stealthy and silent, but swift. Had to be. He who hits first wins the fight, most of the time. We crested a pass, took shelter beneath a thick stand of towering mahogany trees in the triple canopy jungle, and tracked our targets through night vision goggles. Even without sunlight, the tropical heat was intense, and sweat slid down the side of my face like dewdrops on a windowpane. I was 27 years old, and my platoon and Rambo fever dreams had become real as fuck. I blinked twice, exhaled, and on the OIC signal, opened fire. My entire body reverberated with the rhythm of the M60, a belt-fed machine gun, firing 500 to 650 rounds per minute. As the 100-round belt fed the growling machine and flared from the barrel, adrenaline flooded my bloodstream and saturated my brain. My focus narrowed. There was nothing else but me, my weapon, and the target I was shredding with zero apologies. It was 2002. I was fresh out of buds, and as a full-time Navy SEAL, I was now officially one of the world's most fit and deadly warriors, and one of the hardest men alive. Or so I thought. But this was years before my descent into the ultra rabbit hole. September 11th was still a fresh, gaping wound in the American collective consciousness, and its ripple effects changed everything for guys like us. Combat was no longer a mythical state of mind we aspired to. It was real, and ongoing in the mountains, villages, and cities of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, we were moored in fucking Malaysia, awaiting orders, hoping to join the fight. And we trained like it. After BUDS, I moved on to SEAL qualification training, where I officially earned my trident, before landing in my first platoon. Training continued with jungle warfare exercises in Malaysia. We rappelled and fast-roped up and down from hovering helicopters. Some men were trained as snipers, and since I was the biggest man in the unit, my weight was back up to 250 pounds by then, I scored the job of carrying the pig, the nickname for the M60, because it sounded like the grunt of a barnyard hog. Most people dreaded pig detail, but I was obsessed with that gun. The weapon alone was 20 pounds, and each belt of 100 rounds weighed in at 7 pounds. I carried 6 to 7 of those, one on the gun, 4 on my waist, and 1 in a pouch strapped to my rucksack. The weapon and my 50-pound ruck everywhere we went, and was expected to move just as fast as everyone else. I had no choice. We train as we fight, and live ammo is necessary to mimic true combat. So we could perfect the SEAL battle maxim, shoot, move, communicate. That meant keeping barrel discretion on point. We couldn't let our weapons spray just anywhere. That's how friendly fire incidents happen, and it takes great muscle discipline and attention to detail to know where you're aiming in relation to the location of your teammates at all times, especially when armed with a pig. Maintaining a high standard of safety and delivering deadly force on target when duty calls is what makes an average SEAL a good operator. Most people think once you're a SEAL, you're always in the circle, but that's not true. I learned quickly that we were constantly being judged. And the second I was unsafe, whether I was still a new guy or a veteran operator, I'd be out. I was one of 3 new guys in my first platoon, and one of them had to have his gun taken away because he was so unsafe. For 10 days, we moved through the Malaysian jungle, sleeping in hammocks, paddling dugouts, carrying our weapons all day and night, and he was stuck hauling a fucking broomstick like the Wicked Witch of the West. Even then, he couldn't hack it, and wound up getting booted. Our officers in that first platoon kept everybody honest, and I respected them for it. In combat, nobody just turns into Rambo, Dana DeCoster told me recently. Dana was second in command on my first platoon with SEAL Team 5. These days, he's director of operations at BUDS. We push ourselves hard, so when bullets do start flying, we fall back on really good training. And it's important that the point where we fall back is so high, we know we're going to outperform the enemy. We may not become Rambo, but we'll be damn close. A lot of people are fascinated by the weaponry and gunfights SEALs utilize and engage in, but that was never my favorite part of the job. I was damn good at it, but I preferred going to war with myself. I'm talking about strong physical training, and my first platoon delivered that too. We would go on long run-swim runs most mornings before work. We weren't just getting miles in either. We were competing, and our officers led from the front. Our OIC and Dana, his second, were two of the best athletes in the entire platoon, and my platoon chief, Chris Beck, who now goes by Kristen Beck and is one of the most famous trans women on Twitter, talk about being the only, was a hard motherfucker too. "It's funny," Dana said. "The OIC and I never really talked about our philosophy on PT. We just competed. I wanted to beat him, and he wanted to beat me. And that got people talking about how hard we were getting after it." There was never a doubt in my mind that Dana was off his damn rocker. I remember before we shipped out for Indonesia, with stops in Guam, Malaysia, Thailand, and Korea, we did a number of training dives off San Clemente Island. Dana was my swim buddy, and one morning he challenged me to do a training dive in 55-degree water without a wetsuit, because that's how the predecessors to the SEALs did it when they prepared the beaches in Normandy for the famous D-Day invasion during World War II. "Let's go old school and dive in shorts with our dive knives," he said. He had the animalistic mentality I thrived on, and I wasn't about to back down from that challenge. We swam and dove together all over Southeast Asia, where we trained elite military units in Malaysia and sharpened the skills of Thai Navy SEALs, the crew of frogmen who saved the soccer kids in the cave in the summer of 2018. They were engaged with an Islamist insurgency in South Thailand. Wherever we deployed, I loved those PT mornings above all else. Pretty soon, every man in that platoon was competing against everyone else. But no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't seem to catch our two officers, and usually came in third place. Didn't matter. It wasn't important who won, because everybody was capping personal bests almost every day, and that's what stayed with me. The power of a competitive environment to amp up an entire platoon's commitment and achievement. This was exactly the environment I'd been dreaming of when I classed up for BUDS. We were all living the SEAL ethos, and I couldn't wait to see where it took us individually and as a unit once we tagged into the fight. But as war raged in Afghanistan, all we could do was sit tight and hope our number was called. We were in a Korean bowling alley when we watched the invasion of Iraq together. It was depressing as hell. We had been training hard for an opportunity like that. Our foundation had been reinforced with all that PT and filled out with robust weapons and tactical training. We'd become a deadly unit, frothing to be a part of the action, and the fact that we were passed over again pissed us all off. So we took it out on one another every morning. Navy SEALs were treated like rock stars at the bases we visited around the world, and some of the guys partied like it. In fact, most SEALs enjoyed their share of big nights out, but not me. I'd gotten into the SEALs by living a Spartan lifestyle, and felt my job at night was to rest, recharge, and get my body and mind right for battle again the next day. I was forever mission ready, and my attitude earned respect from some. But our OIC tried to influence me to let go a little and become one of the boys. I had great respect for our OIC. He'd graduated from the Naval Academy and the University of Cambridge. He was clearly smart, a stud athlete, and a great leader, on his way to claiming a coveted spot on DevGru. So his opinion mattered to me. It mattered to all of us, because he was responsible for evaluating us, and those evaluations have a way of following you around and affecting your military career going forward. On paper, my first evaluation was solid. He was impressed with my skills and all-out effort, but he also dropped some off-the-record wisdom. "You know, Goggins," he said, "you'd understand the job a little better if you hung out with the guys more. That's when I learned the most about operating in the field, hanging with the boys, hearing their stories. It's important to be part of the group." His words were a reality check that hurt. Clearly the OIC and probably some of the other guys thought I was a little different. Of course I was. I came from fucking nothing. I didn't get recruited to the Naval Academy. I didn't even know where the fuck Cambridge was. I wasn't raised around pools. I had to teach myself to swim. Fuck, I shouldn't even have been a SEAL, but I made it, and I thought that made me part of the group. But now, I realize I was part of the teams, not the Brotherhood. I had to go out and socialize with the guys after hours to prove my value? That was a big ask for an introvert like me. Fuck that. I'd arrived in that platoon because of my intense dedication, and I wasn't about to let up. While people were out at night, I was reading up on tactics, weaponry, and war. I was a perpetual student. In my mind, I was training for opportunities that didn't even exist yet. Back then, you couldn't screen to join DevGru until after you finished your second platoon. But I was already preparing for that opportunity, and I refused to compromise who I was to conform to their unwritten rules. DevGru and the Army's Delta Force are considered the very best within the best of special operations. They get the tip of the spear missions, like the Osama bin Laden raid, and from that point on, I decided I wouldn't and couldn't be satisfied just being a vanilla Navy SEAL. Yeah, we were all uncommon, hard motherfuckers compared to civilians. But now I saw I was uncommon even among the uncommon. And if that's who I was, then so the fuck be it. I may as well separate myself even more. Not long after that evaluation, I won the morning race for the first time. I passed up Dana and the OIC in the last half mile and never looked back. Platoon assignments last for 2 years, and by the end of our deployment, most of the guys were ready for a breather before tackling their next platoon, which, judging by the wars we were involved in, were almost guaranteed to take them into combat. I didn't want or need a break because the uncommon among uncommon don't take breaks. After my first evaluation, I started studying the other branches in the military, Coast Guard not included, and read up on their special forces. Navy SEALs like to think that we're the best of them all, but I wanted to see for myself. I suspected all the branches employed a few individuals who stood out in the worst environments. I was on a hunt to find and train with those guys because I knew they could make me better. Plus, I'd read that Army Ranger School was known as one of the best, if not the best, leadership schools in the entire military. So during my first platoon, I put 7 chits in with my OIC, hoping to get approval to go to Army Ranger School between deployments. I wanted to sponge more knowledge, I told him, and become more skilled as a special operator. Chits are special requests, and my first 6 were ignored. I was a new guy, after all. And some thought my focus should remain within Naval Special Warfare, rather than stray into the dreaded Army. But I'd earned my own reputation after serving 2 years in my first platoon, and my 7th request went up the ladder to the CO in charge of SEAL Team 5. When he signed off, I was in. "Goggins," my OIC said after giving me the good news, "you are the type of motherfucker who wishes you were a POW just to see if you have what it takes to last." He was on to me. He knew the kind of person I was becoming, the type of man willing to challenge myself to the nth degree. We shook hands. The OIC was off to DevGru, and there was a chance we'd meet there soon. He told me that with 2 ongoing wars, for the first time, DevGru had opened their recruitment process to include guys off their first platoon. By always searching for more and preparing my mind and body for opportunities that didn't yet exist, I was one of a handful of men on the West Coast approved by SEAL Team 5 Brass to screen for Green Team, the training program for DevGru, just before I left for Army Ranger School. The Green Team screening process unfolds over 2 days. The first day is the physical fitness portion, which included a 3-mile run, a 1,200-meter swim, 3 minutes of sit-ups and push-ups, and a max set of pull-ups. I smoked everybody, because my first platoon had made me a much stronger swimmer and a better runner. Day 2 was the interview, which was more like an interrogation. Only 3 men from my screening class of 18 guys were approved for Green Team. I was one of them, which theoretically meant that after my second platoon, I'd be one step closer to joining DevGru. I could hardly wait. It was December 2003, and as imagined, my special forces career was zooming into hyperspace because I kept proving myself to be the most uncommon of motherfuckers and remained on track to become that one warrior. A few weeks later, I arrived in Fort Benning, Georgia, for Army Ranger School. It was early December, and as the only Navy guy in a class of 308 men, I was greeted with skepticism by the instructors, because a few classes before mine, a couple of Navy SEALs quit in the middle of training. Back then, they used to send Navy SEALs to Ranger School as punishment, so they may not have been the best representatives. I'd been begging to go, but the instructors didn't know that yet. They thought I was just another cocky special ops guy. Within hours, they stripped me and everyone else of our uniforms and reputations until we all looked the same. Officers lost rank, and minted Special Forces warriors like me became nobodies with a hell of a lot to prove. On day one, we were split into three companies, and I was appointed First Sergeant in command of Bravo Company. I got the job because the original First Sergeant had been asked to recite the Ranger Creed after a beatdown on the pull-up bar, and he was so tired, he fucked it up. To Rangers, their creed is everything. Our Ranger instructor was livid as he took stock of Bravo Company. All of us locked at attention. "I don't know where you think you men are, but if you expect to become Rangers, then I expect you to know our creed." His eyes found me. "I know for a fact old Navy here doesn't know the Ranger creed." You know, Goggins, I could keep reading this as is, but, you know, I think you should take it from here. Like, what happened at that point?
You know what? So I was a student of the military. And the funny thing about it is people know me for running and all this other crap I did, man. But my life was about the military. And so this guy had no idea. You know, he was looking at these guys, these other Navy SEALs that had quit. Man, I was studying the Ranger Creed, man, for months, maybe even a year before I even got there, man. And I was going through it. So when he called me up in front, I was like, "Okay, motherfucker, Ross, this one." So he only wanted me to say the first stanza, you know. So I said the first stanza, and he tried to stop me. So it was like, so I'll say it right now. I still know it. "Recognizing that I volunteered as a ranger, fully knowing the hazards of my chosen profession, I will always endeavor to uphold the prestige, honor, and highest breed corps of the rangers. Acknowledging the fact that a ranger is a more elite soldier who arrives at the cutting edge of battle by land, sea, or air, I accept the fact that as a ranger, my country expects me to move further, faster, and fight harder than any other soldier. Never shall I fail my comrades. I will always keep myself mentally alert, physically strong, and morally straight. And I will shoulder more than my share of the task, whatever it may be, 100% and then some. Gallantly will I show the world that I'm a specially selected and well-trained soldier. My courtesy to superior officers, neatness of dress, and care of equipment shall set the example for others to follow. Energetically will I meet the enemies in my country. I shall defeat them on the field of battle, for I am better trained and will fight with all my might. Surrender is not a ranger word. I will never leave a fallen comrade to fall in the hands of the enemy, and under no circumstances will ever embarrass my country. Readily will I display the intestinal fortitude required to fight on to the ranger objective and complete the mission, though I be the lone survivor. Rangers lead the way." So,
That's amazing. So, I'm ready to charge at something.
So I went to, I was up there, man, and the hair in the back of my neck was going off. I mean, like, I was bald. And by the time I got to saying the Ranger Creed, I had a full afro head of hair. I was just losing my fucking mind, dude. And I was fired up. And then he said, "Hey, Goggins, congratulations. You are now First Sergeant." And I was like, fuck. Now I got to be in charge of all these assholes, man, along with going to Ranger School. So it became challenging, man. But I loved it. I loved it.
He left me there in front of my platoon, speechless. It was now my job to march our platoon around and make sure every man was prepared for whatever lay in front of us. I became part boss, part big brother, and full-time quasi-instructor. In Ranger School, it's hard enough to get yourself squared away enough to graduate. Now I had to look after 100 men and make sure they had their shit together, too. Plus, I still had to go through the same evolutions as everyone else. But that was the easy part, and actually gave me a chance to chill out. For me, the physical punishment was more than manageable. But the way I went about accomplishing those physical tasks had shifted. In BUDS, I'd always led my boat crews, often with tough love. But in general, I didn't care how the guys in other boat crews were doing, or if they quit. This time, I wasn't just putting out. I was also looking after everybody. If I saw someone having trouble with navigation, patrolling, keeping up on a run, or staying awake all night, I made sure we all rallied together to help. Not everybody wanted to. The training was so difficult that when some guys weren't on the clock being graded, they did the bare minimum and found opportunities to rest and hide. In my 69 days at Ranger School, I didn't coast for a single second. I was becoming a true leader. The whole point of Ranger School is to give every man a taste of what it takes to lead a high-level team. The field exercises were like an operator's scavenger hunt blended with an endurance race. Over the course of 6 testing phases, we were evaluated on navigation, weapons, rope techniques, reconnaissance, and overall leadership. The field tests were notorious for their Spartan brutality and capped 3 separate phases of training. First, we were split into groups of 12 men and together spent 5 days and 4 nights in the foothills for Fort Benning phase. We were given very little food to eat, 1 or 2 MREs per day, and only a couple of hours sleep per night as we raced the clock to navigate cross-country terrain between stations, where we'd knock off a series of tasks to prove our proficiency in a particular skill. Leadership in the group rotated between men. Mountain phase was exponentially harder than Fort Benning. Now we were grouped into teams of 25 men to navigate the mountains in North Georgia. And buddy, Appalachia gets cold as fuck in wintertime. I'd read stories about black soldiers with sickle cell trait dying during mountain phase, and the Army wanted me to wear special dog tags with a red casing to alert medics if something went wrong. But I was leading men and didn't want my crew to think of me as some sickly child. So the red casing never quite found its way to my dog tags. In the mountains, we learned how to rappel and rock climb, among other mountaineering skills, and became proficient in ambush techniques and mountain patrol. To prove it, we went out on 2 separate 4-night field training exercises, known as FTXs. A storm blew in during our second FTX. 30-mile-per-hour winds howled with ice and snow. We didn't haul sleeping bags or warm clothes, and again we had very little food. All we could use to keep warm was a poncho liner and one another, which was an issue because the rancid odor in the air was our own. We'd burned so many calories without proper nutrition, we'd lost all our fat and were incinerating our own muscle mass for fuel. The putrid stink made our eyes water. It triggered the gag reflex. Visibility narrowed to a few feet. Guys wheezed, coughed, and jackhammered, their eyes wide with terror. I thought for sure someone was going to die from frostbite, hypothermia, or pneumonia that night. Whenever you stop to sleep during field tests, rest is brief and you're required to maintain security in 4 directions. But in the face of that storm, Bravo Platoon buckled. These were generally very hard men with a ton of pride, but they were focused on survival above all else. I understood the impulse, and the instructors didn't mind because we were in weather emergency mode. But to me, that presented an opportunity to stand apart and lead by example. I looked at that winter storm as a platform to become uncommon among uncommon men. No matter who you are, life will present you similar opportunities where you can prove to be uncommon. There are people in all walks of life who relish those moments. And when I see them, I recognize them immediately because they are usually that motherfucker who's all by himself. It's the suit who's still at the office at midnight while everyone else is at the bar. Or the badass who hits the gym directly after coming off a 48-hour op. She's the wildland firefighter who, instead of hitting her bedroll, sharpens her chainsaw after working a fire for 24 hours. That mentality is there for all of us. Man, woman, straight, gay, black, white, or purple fucking polka dot. All of us can be the person who flies all day and night, only to arrive home to a filthy house, and instead of blaming family or roommates, cleans it up right then because they refuse to ignore duties undone. All over the world, amazing human beings like that exist. It doesn't take wearing a uniform. It's not about all the hard schools they graduated from, all their patches and medals. It's about wanting it like there's no tomorrow, because there might not be. It's about thinking of everybody else before yourself, and developing your own code of ethics that sets you apart from others. One of those ethics is the drive to turn every negative into a positive. And then when shit starts flying, being prepared to lead from the front. My thinking on that Georgia mountaintop was that in a real-world scenario, a storm like that would provide the perfect cover for an enemy attack. So I didn't group up and seek warmth. I dialed deeper, welcomed the carnage of ice and snow, and held the western perimeter like it was my duty, because it damn well was. And I loved every second of it. I squinted into the wind, and as hail stung my cheeks, I screamed into the night from the depths of my misunderstood soul. A few guys heard me, popped out of the tree line to the north, and stood tall. Then another guy emerged to the east, and another on the edge of the south-facing slope. They were all shivering, wrapped in their measly poncho liners. None of them wanted to be there, but they rose up and did their duty. In spite of one of the most brutal storms in Ranger school history, we held a complete perimeter until the instructors radioed us to come in from the cold. Literally. They put up a circus tent. We filed in and huddled up until the storm passed. The final weeks in Ranger school are called Florida Phase, a 10-day FTX in which 50 men navigate the panhandle, GPS point by GPS point, as a single unit. It started with a static line jump from an aircraft at 1,500 feet into frigid swamplands near Fort Walton Beach. We waded and swam across rivers, set up rope bridges, and with our hands and feet shimmied back to the other side. We couldn't stay dry, and the water temperature was in the high 30s and low 40s. We'd all heard the story that during the winter of 1994, it got so cold, four would-be rangers died of hypothermia during Florida Phase. Being near the beach, freezing my nuts off, reminded me of Hell Week. Whenever we stopped, guys were nut to butt and jackhammering. But as usual, I focused hard and refused to show any weakness. This time, it wasn't about taking the souls of our instructors. It was about giving courage to the men who were struggling. I'd cross the river 6 times if that's what it took to help one of my guys tie off his rope bridge. I'd walk them step by step through the process until they could prove their value to the Ranger brass. We slept very little, ate even less, and continually knocked off reconnaissance tasks, hitting waypoints, setting up bridges and weapons, and preparing for ambush, while taking turns leading a group of 50 men. Those men were tired, hungry, cold, frustrated, and they did not want to be there anymore. Most were at their ultimate edge, their 100%. I was getting there too, but even when it wasn't my turn to lead, I helped out. Because in those 69 days of Ranger school, I learned that if you want to call yourself a leader, that's what it takes. A true leader stays exhausted, abhors arrogance, and never looks down on the weakest link. He fights for his men and leads by example. That's what it meant to be uncommon among uncommon. It meant being one of the best and helping your men find their best too. It was a lesson I'd wish sunk in a lot deeper, because in just a few more weeks, I'd be challenged in the leadership department. And come up well short. Ranger school was so demanding, and the standards were so high, that only 96 men graduated out of a class of 308 candidates, and the majority of them were from Bravo Platoon. I was awarded Enlisted Honor Man and received 100% peer evaluation. To me, that meant even more, because my classmates, my fellow knuckle-draggers, had valued my leadership in harsh conditions. And one look in the mirror revealed just how harsh those conditions were. I lost 56 pounds in Ranger school. I looked like death. My cheeks were sunken. My eyes bugged out. I had no bicep muscle left. All of us were emaciated. Guys had trouble running down the block. Men who could do 40 pull-ups in one go now struggled to do a single one. The Army expected that and scheduled 3 days between the end of Florida Phase and graduation to fatten us up before our families flew in to celebrate. As soon as the final FTX was called, we hustled straight to Chow Hall. I piled my tray with donuts, fries, and cheeseburgers, and went looking for the milk machine. After drinking all those damn chocolate shakes when I was down and out, my body had become lactose intolerant, and I hadn't touched dairy in years. But that day I was like a little child, unable to stifle a primordial yearning for a glass of milk. I found the milk machine, pulled the lever down, and watched confused as it funneled out chunky as cottage cheese. I shrugged and sniffed. It smelled all kinds of wrong, but I remember downing that spoiled milk like it was a fresh glass of sweet tea, courtesy of another hellacious Special Forces school that put us through so much. By the end, anybody who survived was grateful for their cold glass of spoiled milk. Man, how did that taste?
Man, first of all, right? You know those old school milk machines, like with that silver handle?
Yeah.
With the big old ball on it, yeah. And you pull them down. All I remember, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to see this nice milk pour out of here. And it kind of clumped into my glass. And I was like, man, but I remember thinking, man, I'm drinking this.
Because you wanted the milk so
much?
I was
thinking, man, you know what? If Uncle Sam has it in here, it must be good to drink.
You are all in.
You know, I'm that kind of guy, man, that, you know, if you want me married in the military, Uncle Sam got to issue me a wife. That customer guy was married twice in the military.
That's it. Too bad Uncle Sam didn't do it.
No, I'm telling you, man, you know, he didn't issue me the white right, you know, the correct woman.
Yes, that's it.
But I will tell you this, man, a lot of people talk to me about, you know, because I was in the Air Force and then, you know, I was a Navy SEAL for, you know, 16 years or whatever, and going through Ranger School, and you're here in a second. I go through some more training somewhere else. I don't want to ruin it for you all. This school right here, it sucked real bad for me.
Yeah.
Because in SEAL training, what they do is, yeah, they kick the crap out of you, man. But at nighttime, you know, you go home, you know, if it's not Hell Week, you know, you go home, you know, you can watch TV, you can go on a date, you can do whatever you want, man, get a lot of food. Here at Ranger School, man, you are locked tight at Ranger School and they feed you hardly at all.
Yeah.
And for me going, you know, going through BUDS so many times, you get used to eating. And food is your fuel. So the more you eat, the more energy you have. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, first day of BUDS, the doctor, you know, I mean, the doctor comes out and gives us his med brief. And he says, hey, so we're all thinking, you know, he's going to tell us about different kind of diets and what kind of nutrition, all sort of stuff. He goes, no. In BUDS, if you see a full-on pie or a cake, eat it.
Mm.
He said, because you're burning so many calories. If you don't get those calories back in your body, you know, you're going to have a hard time going through here. So at Ranger School, what they do so well is they don't feed you well and, you know, you get zero sleep.
Right.
So there's this one time, I'll tell you a funny story. I was on one of my last patrols and I was the PL. I was the, platoon leader out there on a operation. And we're going through and I had my navigator up front. And he puts his fist up like, hey, stop. So I halt the whole group. Everybody puts a fist up to kind of pass the word back in line. And once you pass the word back in line, the scary thing about that is those guys now who are supposed to be taking a knee and then taking security while you're trying to figure out, you know, do like a map study. These guys in the back, you know, I mean, you have 50 guys now you're in charge of. They're falling asleep.
Hmm.
So they're back there falling asleep. This guy calls me up front. It says, hey, Goggins, the RIs, which is Ranger instructors, they put a box of donuts up here. And I'm like, really? So I'm walking up, man. I'm like, oh, man, this is great. You know, towards the end. So, you know, so you're thinking maybe they're hooking us up with some donuts. I walk up there. It's a log. I mean, this guy is out of his mind. He's starving. It's a freaking log.
He thinks he's hallucinating.
He's hallucinating his ass off.
It's an oasis.
I mean, I want to beat the shit out of him right now, man, because I'm hungry as hell, and he told me some box of donuts up here. So anyway, we start moving up. We get about a mile further into the hump. And so I call for, you know, like a head count to go back, pass it back up. So the guys are looking back around them. And one of our guys fell asleep by the tree a mile back. So if you show up at your soon-to-be new location and the, you know, RIs, Ranger instructors, are checking you out, and I got, you know, and I'm down a guy, I'm getting kicked out.
Yeah.
So now we got to go back and get this guy. I mean, the whole school, man, it's attention to detail when you are the most fucked up.
On edge.
Yeah, sleepy, hungry. It's a stressful school, man, because they, you know, they'll call you in charge at 2 a.m.
Hmm.
Hey, Goggins. You know, you are now in charge of these 50 men. It's 2 a.m. You're hungry. It's raining sideways and you gotta, you know, you gotta Roger up.
I love the idea of them stripping everyone of rank and identity within the military, too, and how everyone's just kind of their own. Everyone's a private, basically.
Oh, you know what? I love that probably the most, because my whole mentality has always been, you know, a lot of people have this mentality of I've arrived.
Mm.
And one of my big secrets is I've never arrived. And going to Ranger school, I was a SEAL. You know, and most SEALs have a little chip on their shoulder, you know. I'm not going to Ranger school, you know, that's beneath me. For me, I was like, this is great. I'm back to nobody. I'm back to, you know, Seaman Smuckatelli. I am fucking Seaman Smuckatelli. I am nobody. I am not a SEAL. I'm not nothing. I'm just some punk ass. Give me a rucksack, get your weapon, and follow me.
Mm.
And I was like, Roger that. But that mentality you'll see here in a second, man, starts to, you know, not pay off. So you'll see in a little bit.
Most people take a couple weeks off to recover from Ranger school and put some weight back on. Most people do that. The day of graduation, on Valentine's Day, I flew into Coronado to meet up with my second platoon. Once again, I looked at that lack of lag time as an opportunity to be uncommon. Not that anybody else was watching, but when it comes to mindset, it doesn't matter where other people's attention lies. I had my own uncommon standards to live up to. At every stop I'd made in the SEALs, from Buds to that first platoon to Ranger School, I was known as a hard motherfucker. And when the OIC in my second platoon put me in charge of PT, I was encouraged because it told me that once again, I'd landed with a group of men who were driven to put out and get better. Inspired, I bent my brain to think of evil shit we could do to get us battle ready. This time we all knew we'd deploy to Iraq, and I made it my mission to help us become the hardest SEAL platoon in the fight. That was a high bar, set by the original Navy SEAL legend, still lodged like an anchor deep in my brain. Our legend suggested we were the type of men to swim 5 miles on Monday, run 20 miles on Tuesday, and climb a 14,000-foot peak on Wednesday. And my expectations were sky fucking high. For the first week, guys rallied at 5 a.m. for a run, swim, run, or a 12-mile ruck, followed by a lap through the O course. We carried logs over the berm and hammered hundreds of push-ups. I had us doing the hard shit, the real shit, the workouts that made us SEALs. Each day, the workouts were harder than the last, and over the course of a week or two, that wore people down. Every alpha male in special ops wants to be the best at everything they do. But with me leading PT, they couldn't always be the best, because I never gave them a break. We were all breaking down and showing weakness. That was the idea. But they didn't want to be challenged like that every day. During the second week, attendance flagged, and the OIC and the chief of our platoon took me aside. "Look, dude," our OIC said, "this is stupid. What are we doing?" "We aren't in Buds anymore, Goggins," said the chief. To me, this wasn't about being in Buds. This was about living the SEAL ethos and earning the Trident every day. These guys wanted to do their own PT, which typically meant hitting the gym and getting big. They weren't interested in being punished physically, and definitely weren't interested in being pushed to meet my standard. Their reaction shouldn't have surprised me, but it sure as hell disappointed me and made me lose all respect for their leadership. I understood that not everyone wanted to work out like an animal for the rest of their career, because I didn't want to do that shit either. But what put distance between me and almost everybody else in that platoon is that I didn't let my desire for comfort rule me. I was determined to go to war with myself to find more, because I believed it was our duty to maintain a Buds mentality and prove ourselves every day. Navy SEALs are revered the world over and are thought to be the hardest men that God ever created. But that conversation made me realize that wasn't always true. I had just come from Ranger School, a place where nobody has any rank at all. Even if a general had classed up, he'd have been in the same clothes we all had to wear, that of an enlisted man on day one of basic fucking training. We were all maggots reborn, with no future and no past, starting at zero. I loved that concept, because it sent a message that no matter what we'd accomplished in the outside world, as far as the Rangers were concerned, we weren't shit. And I claim that metaphor for myself, because it's always and forever true. No matter what you or I achieve in sports, business, or life, we can't be satisfied. Life is too dynamic of a game. We're either getting better or we're getting worse. Yes, we need to celebrate our victories. There's power in victory that's transformative. But after our celebration, we should dial it down, dream up new training regimens, new goals, and start at zero the very next day. I wake up every day as if I am back in Buds. Day one, week one. Starting at zero is a mindset that says my refrigerator is never full, and it never will be. We can always become stronger and more agile, mentally and physically. We can always become more capable and more reliable. Since that's the case, we should never feel that our work is done. There is always more to do. Are you an experienced scuba diver? Great. Shed your gear, take a deep breath, and become a 100-foot free diver. Are you a badass triathlete? Cool. Learn how to rock climb. Are you enjoying a wildly successful career? Wonderful. Learn a new language or skill. Get a second degree. Always be willing to embrace ignorance and become the dumb fuck in the classroom again, because that is the only way to expand your body of knowledge and body of work. It's the only way to expand your mind. During week two of my second platoon, my chief and OIC showed their cards. It was devastating to hear that they didn't feel that we needed to earn our status every day. Sure, all the guys I worked with over the years were relatively hard guys and highly skilled. They enjoyed the challenges of the job, the brotherhood, and being treated like superstars. They all loved being SEALs, but some weren't interested in starting at zero because just by qualifying to breathe rare air, they were already satisfied. Now that is a very common way of thinking. Most people in the world, if they ever push themselves at all, are willing to push themselves only so far. Once they reach a cushy plateau, they chill the fuck out and enjoy their rewards. But there's another phrase for that mentality. It's called getting soft, and that I could not abide. As far as I was concerned, I had my own reputation to uphold, and when the rest of the platoon opted out of my custom-made hellscape, the chip on my shoulder grew even bigger. I ramped up my workouts and vowed to put out so hard it would hurt their fucking feelings. As head of PT, that was not in my job description. I was supposed to inspire guys to give more. Instead, I saw what I considered a glaring weakness and let them know I wasn't impressed. In one short week, my leadership regressed light years from where I was in Ranger School. I lost touch with my situational awareness and didn't respect the men in my platoon enough. As a leader, I was trying to bull my way through, and they bucked against that. Nobody gave an inch, including the officers. I suppose all of us took a path of least resistance. I just didn't notice it, because physically, I was going harder than ever. And I had one guy with me. Sledge was a hard motherfucker who grew up in San Bernardino, the son of a firefighter and a secretary. And like me, he taught himself to swim in order to pass the swim test and qualify for Buds. He was only a year older, but was already in his fourth platoon. He was also a heavy drinker, a little overweight, and looking to change his life. The morning after the chief, the OIC, and I had words, Sledge showed up at 5 a.m. ready to roll. I'd been there since 4:30 and had a lather of sweat working already. I like what you're doing with these workouts, he said, and I want to keep doing them. Roger that. From then on, no matter where we were stationed, whether that was Coronado, Nyland, or Iraq, we got after it every single morning. We'd meet up at 4 a.m. and get to it. Sometimes that meant running up the side of a mountain before hitting the O course at high speed and carrying logs up and over the berm and down the beach. In Buds, usually six men carried those logs. We did it with just the two of us. On another day, we rocked a pull-up pyramid, hitting sets of one, all the way up to 20, and back down to one again. After every other set, we'd climb a rope 40 feet high. 1,000 pull-ups before breakfast became our new mantra. At first, Sledge struggled to rock one set of 10 pull-ups. Within months, he'd lost 35 pounds and was hitting 100 sets of 10. In Iraq, it was impossible to get long runs in, so we lived in the weight room. We did hundreds of deadlifts and spent hours on the hip sled. We went way beyond overtraining. We didn't care about muscle fatigue or breakdown, because after a certain point, we were training our minds, not our bodies. My workouts weren't designed to make us fast runners or to be the strongest men on the mission. I was training us to take torture so we'd remain relaxed in extraordinarily uncomfortable environments. And shit did get uncomfortable from time to time. Despite the clear divide within our platoon, Sledge and me versus everyone else, we operated well together in Iraq. Off-duty, however, there was a huge gulf between who the two of us were becoming and who I thought the men in my platoon were, and my disappointment showed. I wore my shitty attitude around like a shroud, thus earning me the platoon nickname, David Leave Me Alone Goggins, and never woke up to realize that my disappointment was my own problem, not my teammates' fault. That's the drawback of becoming uncommon amongst uncommon. You can push yourself to a place that is beyond the current capability or temporal mindset of the people you work with, and that's okay. Just know that your supposed superiority is a figment of your own ego, so don't lord it over them, because it won't help you advance as a team or as an individual in your field. Instead of getting angry that your colleagues can't keep up, help pick your colleagues up and bring them with you. We are all fighting the same battle. All of us are torn between comfort and performance, between settling for mediocrity or being willing to suffer in order to become our best self, all the damn time. We make those kinds of decisions a dozen or more times each day. My job as head of PT wasn't to demand that my guys live up to the Navy SEAL legend I loved. It was to help them become the best version of themselves. But I never listened, and I didn't lead. Instead, I got angry and showed up my teammates. For 2 years, I played the tough guy and never took a step back with a calm mind to address my original error. I had countless opportunities to bridge the gap I'd helped create, but I never did. And it cost me. I didn't realize any of that right away, because after my second platoon, I was ordered to free fall school, then made an assaults instructor. Both were posts scheduled to prep me for green team. Assaults was critical, because most people who get cut from green team are dismissed for sloppy house runs. They move too slow when clearing buildings, are too easily exposed, or are amped up and trigger happy and end up shooting friendly targets. Teaching those skills made me clinical, stealthy, and calm in confined environments, and I expected to receive my orders to train with DevGru in Dam Neck, Virginia, any day, but they never came. The other two guys who'd rocked the screening with me received their orders. Mine went AWOL. I called leadership at Dam Neck. They told me to screen again, and that's when I knew something was off. I thought about the process I'd been through. Did I really expect to do better? I smoked that shit. But then I remembered the actual interview, which felt more like an interrogation, with two men playing good cop, bad cop. They didn't probe my skill set or Navy know-how. 85% of their questions had nothing to do with my ability to operate whatsoever. The bulk of that interview was about my race. "We're a bunch of good old boys," one of them said, "and we need to know how you're going to handle hearing black jokes, bro." Most of their questions were a variation on that one theme, and through it all, I smiled and thought, "How are you white boys gonna feel when I'm the baddest motherfucker in here?" But that's not what I said, and it wasn't because I was intimidated or uncomfortable. I was more at home in that interview than anywhere I'd been in the military, because for the first time in my life, it was out in the fucking open. They weren't trying to pretend that being one of only a handful of black guys in perhaps the most revered military organization in the world didn't have its own unique set of challenges. One guy was challenging me with his aggressive posture and tone. The other guy kept it cool, but they were both being real. There were two or three black men in DevGru already, and they were telling me that entry into their inner circle required my signing off on certain terms and conditions. And in a sick way, I loved that message and the challenge that came with it. DevGru was a hard-ass renegade crew within the SEALs, and they wanted it to stay that way. They didn't want to civilize anybody. They didn't want to evolve or change. And I knew where I was and what I was getting myself into. This crew was responsible for the most dangerous tip-of-the-spear missions. It was a white man's underworld, and these guys needed to know how I'd act if someone started to fuck with me. They needed assurances I could control my emotions, and once I saw through their language into the greater purpose, I couldn't be offended by their act. "Look, I've experienced racism my entire life," I replied, "and there is nothing any of you fuckers can say to me that I haven't heard 20 times before. But be ready, because I'm coming right the fuck back at you." At the time, they seemed to like the sound of that. Trouble is, when you're a black guy giving it back, it usually doesn't go over nearly as well. I will never know why I didn't receive my orders for green team, and it doesn't matter. We can't control all the variables in our lives. It's about what we do with the opportunities revoked or presented to us that determine how a story ends. Instead of thinking, "I crushed the screening process once, I can do it again," I decided to start at zero and screen for Delta Force, the Army's version of DevGru, instead. So, David, let's talk about that. You know, kind of the second platoon in general and the DevGru experience. What's on your mind?
So you know what? I don't talk about my military experience too much, probably because of this second platoon right here and how this kind of changed my whole outlook. So when I went through those 3 hell weeks and I started realizing more and more about me, and I started realizing even in that third time when I got through that 235 in that buds class, that's when it started hitting me, man. Like, even if you're a bad motherfucker, I don't care if you're Roger Federer from tennis or, you know, whoever the hell you may be, LeBron James, whatever. I believe that we are all underachieving to a certain point, which is why the best of the best are constantly training hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like LeBron James right now, man, he's still, you know, he's still trying to find like even more of an edge.
Yeah.
And if you were to talk to all these guys after they retire, and, you know, let's say you were interviewing Roger, I guarantee you, he'd look in your eyes as, you know, as the interviewer was saying, man, you were amazing, Roger. You were this, you were that. I guarantee you, he'd be looking back, not on the great success he had. He'd be looking back at all the times he missed that shot.
Mm.
Or he should have won that Grand Slam. But, and it, so that's what makes you great. So I started realizing, my God, man, anybody else would have quit in this hell week. My body was broken. You know, it had been, you know, it was my third time around. So I started, you know, realizing, my God, man, I could have easily went home on these broken legs saying, hey, man, that was my 100%. I'm out of here. But I didn't. And at that point, I realized, my God, man, there's so much more left in the tank. So I took that mentality, and that's the mindset that separates us all from good to great.
Right.
That's the great separator. So I was like, you know what? I'm in the great place. I'm in the best place in the world to kind of like, you know, these SEALs, you know, we're supposed to be the hardest men ever. So I'm now going to take this mentality and I'm going to start sampling it. So I became the Stephen Hawking. You know, that guy became obsessed with, with learning. I became obsessed with the mind. How much further can we go? And I thought I was in the great, you know, kind of like trial ground. So that became my problem.
So being the leader of PT for the second platoon was almost like you were the mad scientist with all these lab rats, and you could push them and see what happens and see if you can create more of you.
Yeah, they're SEALs.
Right.
And after, you know what's funny? After every single 100-miler, even after Badwater, the first time I did Badwater, when I got through Badwater, not many people knew I was a SEAL. Once they found out I was a SEAL, they said, oh my God, you're a SEAL. This is probably easy for you. And all I'm thinking about is, I don't see SEALs doing this shit.
Only you.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, even though, you know, some guys are deployed, some guys aren't. I was putting 100-mile weeks, you know, while I was doing all kind of SEAL shit.
Yeah.
It's just they didn't do that.
Right.
But in my mind, you know, before I got in, man, I was watching these movies and reading these fucking books and all this shit, man. And I put the SEALs on an almost impossible level in my mind.
Yeah.
So when I was going through Hell Week, I was like, man, to be a Navy SEAL, you're supposed to be able to run on broken bones.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be a guy that, you know, cut your fucking arm off and still swim 200 miles. You know, that was the mentality I had, because that's all that was said about them.
Right. And so motivated you to get through that Hell Week, and which in turn kind of set you up for this path through ultras.
Right.
But then you get to your second platoon before the ultra thing really takes off. And so you're still kind of living off of that third Hell Week, and you've done 2 Hell Weeks and actually part of 3. And you get that news that actually, wait a second, that legend isn't always accurate. And that kind of like took the wind out.
Oh, it took more than the wind out, because what made me who I was at that time was that legend.
Yeah.
That, and I'm not saying every guy, you know, isn't, you know, every guy is not getting after. Yeah, there are some guys who are getting after, like, you know, we'll talk about Hawk here in a second. But it just wasn't, I thought everybody that had a Trident on was just crushing shit.
Right.
I mean, every day fucking, hey, you want to go 50 miles? Let's go, motherfucker. Let's do it. You want to run? I mean, whatever it was. But I realized a lot of guys after that Trident was on their chest, it was like, hey, man, you know what? I'm not killing my fucking self. And I realized I had a very grunt-like mentality. So I look at the SEALs and some other special operations units. Yeah, they're great. They're truly amazing. But they are more of like the Harvard, like, hey, I'm here. I'm good. I'm not going to break my ass anymore. And my mentality was, hey, man, I haven't come anywhere. I haven't arrived at all.
Yeah, there were some satisfied guys, is what
right.
you saw.
Yeah, very satisfied. So that's what happened to me, and it literally kind of fucked me up when I had that conversation with my OIC and my chief, and my attitude got really foul.
Right.
It got real foul.
And that's where it kind of comes around, is you have to own that part of it, because you didn't have to let that derail you, but you did.
Right. And I mean, it did big time. But what happened also here was, you know, when I was growing up, I always wanted to be around the best because I always felt like I was the worst. So when I finally got there, I was like, man, this is great. You know, these are the best of the best. And on top of that, man, it was one of the situations in my life that truly jacked me up, man. And I was so used to trying to fit in back in the day. But by this time in my life, I had worked my ass off so hard, with losing the weight and learning how to read and write and overcoming so much on my own, I didn't give a fuck anymore who liked me or who didn't like. I wasn't trying to fit in with the SEAL teams.
Right. And you think in the end, that's probably what hurt your chances with Green Team and DevGrew. It really wasn't most likely the racist interview, although
no.
You never know. But it was probably because, it seems like DevGrew should have been a hardcore group that doesn't want necessarily likable people. They should want the best people.
Right.
But it turned out maybe they wanted a little bit of likable in there.
Well, you know what? It is true. The SEAL teams is a brotherhood. And there's a bunch of badass guys who are great shooters, movers, and communicators. You know, I wasn't part of the brotherhood. I was a Navy SEAL. I was part of the teams, but I was not part of the brotherhood, man. I didn't do anything that they did. I was a good team player, but that whole brotherhood thing was something that happened outside of actual work.
The fraternity aspect.
Yeah, the fraternity of it, and I'm not a fraternity guy. So, that ended up hurting me quite a bit, but it also drove me.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, man, fuck it, man. Let's go. We often eat our own. So in the SEAL teams, we eat our own. In a lot of special operations units, man, you eat your own.
Yeah.
But I actually loved that mentality, truthfully, man. So there's a lot of things that happened, within the platoon.
Well, you eventually found your vantage point and it ended up getting you onto the ultra circuit and doing all that. But so this is just kind of we've told that story and now we're going back, and this is kind of sets up that whole angle.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, you got to pull out of all, you got to pull something good out of all the bad.
But you didn't stop trying to join the tip of the spear crews. You decided to go Army, and that also might have hurt you with the SEALs, right?
Yeah. That wasn't a good deal. So by this time, when I didn't get orders to Green Team, I had that kind of like, something was going on here. I was like, okay, fuck you. I'm going to go ahead now and go over to the Army, and I'm going to fucking knock that shit out. But I was obsessed with the military. So I actually saw this as like, this is kind of good, man. I can now screen for Delta Force, because why? I was on a hunt for the most uncommon people to ever live. So I was like, hey, man, I've never sampled that. Let me go over there and see if these guys are, better than the guys I work with. And this gave me a great opportunity to do that.
Delta selection is rigorous, and I'd always been intrigued by it due to the elusive nature of the group. Unlike SEALs, you never heard about Delta. The screening for Delta selection included an IQ test, a complete military resume, including my qualifications and war experience, and my evaluations. I pulled all of that together in a few days, knowing that I was competing against the best guys from every military branch, and that only the cream would be extended an invitation. My Delta orders came through in a matter of weeks. Not long after that, I landed in the mountains of West Virginia, ready to compete for a spot among the Army's very best soldiers. Strangely, there was no yelling or screaming in the Delta void. There was no muster and no OICs. The men that showed up there were all self-starters, and our orders were chalked on a board hanging in the barracks. For 3 days, we weren't allowed to leave the compound. Our focus was rest and acclimatization. But on day 4, P PT started up with the basic screening test, which included 2 minutes of push-ups, 2 minutes of sit-ups, and a timed 2-mile run. They expected everyone to meet a minimum standard, and those that didn't were sent home. From there, things got immediately and progressively more difficult. In fact, later that same night, we had our first road march. Like everything in Delta, officially the distance was unknown, but I believe it was about an 18-mile course from start to finish. It was cold and very dark when all 160 of us took off, strapped with around 40-pound rucksacks. Most guys started out in a slow march, content to pace themselves and hike it out. I took off hot, and in the first quarter mile left everyone behind. I saw an opportunity to become uncommon and seized it, and I finished about 30 minutes before anybody else. Delta Selection is the best orienteering course in the world. For the next 10 days, we hammered PT in the morning and worked on advanced land navigation skills into the night. They taught us how to get from A to B by reading the terrain instead of roads and trails on a map. We learned to read fingers and cuts, and that if you get high, you want to stay high. We were taught to follow water. When you start reading the land this way, your map comes alive. And for the first time in my life, I became great at orienteering. We learned to judge distance and how to draw our own topographic maps. At first, we were assigned an instructor to tail through the wildlands, and those instructors hauled ass. For the next few weeks, we were on our own. Technically, we were still practicing, but we were also being graded and watched to make sure we were moving cross-country instead of taking roads. It all culminated with an extended final exam in the field that lasted 7 days and nights, if we even made it that far. This wasn't a team effort. Each of us was on our own to use our map and compass to navigate from one waypoint to the next. There was a Humvee at every stop, and the cadres, our instructors and evaluators there, noted our time and gave us the next set of coordinates. Each day was its own unique challenge, and we never knew how many points we'd have to navigate before the test was done. Plus, there was an unknown time limit that only the cadres were privy to. At the finish line, we weren't told if we passed or failed. Instead, we were directed to one of two covered Humvees. The good truck took you to the next camp. The bad truck motored back to base, where you would have to pack your shit and head home. Most of the time, I didn't know if I made it for sure until the truck stopped. By day 5, I was one of roughly 30 guys still in consideration for Delta Force. There were only 3 days left, and I was rocking every test, coming in at least 90 minutes before drop dead time. The final test would be a 40-mile ball kicker of a land navigation, and I was looking forward to that. But first, I had work to do. I splashed through washes, huffed up sloped woodlands, and rambled along ridgelines, point to point, until the unthinkable happened. I got lost. I was on the wrong ridge. I double-checked my map and compass and looked across a valley to the correct one, due south. Roger that. For the first time, the clock became a factor. I didn't know the drop-dead time, but knew I was cutting it close. So I sprinted down a steep ravine, but lost my footing. My left foot jammed between two boulders. I rolled over my ankle and felt it pop. The pain was immediate. I checked my watch, gritted my teeth, and laced my boot tight as quickly as I could, then hobbled up a steep hillside to the correct ridge. On the final stretch to the finish, my ankle blew up so bad, I had to untie my boot to relieve the pain. I moved slow, convinced I would be sent home. I was wrong. My Humvee unloaded us at the second-to-last base camp of Delta Selection, where I iced my ankle all night, knowing that thanks to my injury, the next day's land navigation test was likely beyond my capability. But I didn't quit. I showed up, fought to stay in the mix, but missed my time on one of the early checkpoints, and that was that. I didn't hang my head, because injuries happen. I'd given it everything I had, and when you handle business like that, your effort will not go unnoticed. Delta cadres are like robots. Throughout selection, they didn't show any personality. But as I was getting ready to leave the compound, one of the officers in charge called me into his office. "Goggins," he said, extending his hand, "you are a stud. We want you to heal up, come back, and try again. We believe you will be a great addition to Delta Force someday." But when? I came to from my second heart surgery in a billowing cloud of anesthesia. I looked over my right shoulder to an IV drip and followed the flow to my veins. I was wired to the medical mind. Beeping heart monitors recorded data to tell a story in a language beyond my comprehension. If only I were fluent, Maybe I'd know if my heart was finally whole, if there ever would be a someday. I placed my hand over my heart, closed my eyes, and listened for clues. After leaving Delta, I went back to the SEAL teams and was assigned to land warfare as an instructor instead of a warrior. At first, my morale flagged. Men who lacked my skills, commitment, and athletic ability were in the field in two countries, and I was moored in no man's land, wondering how it had all gone so haywire so quickly. It felt like I'd hit a glass ceiling, but had it always been there, or did I slide it into place myself? The truth was somewhere in between. I realized from living in Brazil, Indiana, that prejudice is everywhere. There is a piece of it in every person and each and every organization. And if you are the only in any given situation, it's on you to decide how you're going to handle it, because you can't make it go away. For years, I used it to fuel me, because there's a lot of power in being the only. It forces you to juice your own resources and to believe in yourself in the face of unfair scrutiny. It increases the degree of difficulty, which makes every success that much sweeter. That's why I continually put myself in situations where I knew I would encounter it. I fed off being the only one in a room. I brought the war to people and watched my excellence explode small minds. I didn't sit back and cry about being the only. I took action, said go fuck yourself, and used all the prejudice I felt as dynamite to blow up those walls. But that kind of raw material will only get you so far in life. I was so confrontational, I created needless enemies along the way, and I believe that's what limited my access to the top SEAL teams. With my career at a crossroads, I didn't have time to dwell on those mistakes. I had to find higher ground and turn the negative I'd created into another positive. I didn't just accept land warfare duty. I was the best instructor I could possibly be, and on my own time, I created new opportunities for myself by launching my Ultra Quest, which revived my stalled career. I was right back on track until I learned I'd been born with a broken heart. Yet there was a positive side to that, too. Tucked into my post-op hospital bed, I looked to be fading in and out of consciousness as conversations between doctors, nurses, my wife and mother bled into one another like white noise. They had no clue that I was wide awake the whole time, listening to my wounded heart beat and smiling inside, knowing I finally had definitive, scientific proof that I was as uncommon as any motherfucker who has ever lived. Well, there you go, Chapter 9.
Yes, sir, it's a great one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're pulling the curtain back a little bit on the Navy SEAL legend, and let's not overstate it. I mean, we all know that the people who make it through Hell Week and become SEALs, they're hard motherfuckers, and you say that very clearly. But what you're saying is that there's some people that have a more uncommon way of thinking than others, and not everybody is like this uncommon motherfucker in the SEAL teams. But there are some, you know, SBG is one, and then there is a guy named Hawk who, when you started doing the ultras, you started crossing paths with him in some funny ways.
Now, let's not get it wrong, man. Navy SEAL training, you know, I've been through most all of it. It's some hard-ass shit. And I think it just, you know, it beats you down in a way where it's almost like, you know what, man, I'm going to work out, but I'm not going to go to that level of I kill myself. Because what they do so well in SEAL training, man, is they must make you afraid to go back in the water. You know, so all these things, you know, like, I mean, you run your ass into a nub. And so I'm not trying to get people a get out of jail free card, but my mindset had changed. You know, I was becoming very granimalistic right now at this time. And so there's a great story, man, about, so at this time now, you know, my whole mind's changed, you know, my whole mindset's different. I'm kind of pissed off at some people and a whole bunch of people in the SEAL teams, man. You know what? They didn't like me. I didn't like them. I had a chip on my shoulder. And that's, truth be told, that's exactly what it was for me. And they didn't respect me. I didn't respect them. So I'm training right now for Delta Force training, and a lot of their training is you have a rucksack on your back and you're going. So it's a Saturday morning and I'm going for a long, long ruck. And I'm just out there by myself thinking, man, you know, I'm going to get after it, man, by myself, all alone. That's how I love being alone in my own mind and just being hard, because no one was out there. No one saw me. And that's how I liked it. But I'll never forget this day. I'm out there rucking. I was doing a 20-mile ruck, and I look up on this road with no cars, nobody around, early in the morning, and I see another guy. I'm running. This guy's he's hiking real fast. And I can tell he has some straps coming down on his shoulders. I'm like, this guy's got a pack on. So I get closer. He's a fairly big guy. And as we're getting real close, I look up, and it's a buddy of mine named Hawk. He's a fellow, you know, team guy, and he was at DevGrew and stuff like this. And we share a lot of the same mentality. So that, you know, as I was passing him, he was going 30 miles. This cat was doing 30. I was running 20, and it literally threw like a bolt of energy through me, because I was like, oh my God, there's one of them right there. He gets it. So we still talk about it today. A lot of the training we did together, we see each other all the time.
Yeah, I remember you, when we talked to him for 2.5 hours or something, at least the first conversation.
Right.
And he, I remember he recalled one time when you were commuting to Coronado by running, when yep. you were getting ready for Hurt, I think it was, or yep. might have been Badwater days, I forget, but it was in those early ultra days, and you'd be turned down onto the Silver Strand bike path and see this motherfucker like dragging tires in the sand.
Yeah, man. So I'd be running, and I look over to my left, and there was, it was called like the demo pit road. This son of a bitch had a big old truck tire in his car, and also carried like a pull up bar, like, you know, those old, like them contraptions with the dip bar, pull up bar.
Yeah.
He had that in the back of his truck. This cat has strapped to him a tire, just pulling it through the soft sand. So he's collecting all that sand as he ran. And I was like, man, I want to work with you. And that's how I got along with, you know, like I'm with my first platoon, because the OYC and the AOYC, not everybody in that platoon really get after it, but most guys did. But the leaders were getting after it. So that's what fueled me. I wanted their respect. And in my second platoon, I no longer care if they respected me or not, because I didn't respect them. And that was a bad, bad mindset. And one more story I give you about the whole rucking thing. So before my second heart surgery, I was going in, and I knew at this time I was going to try to go back to Delta Force training for another shot. I knew I was going to try to go back. And basically I'm sitting there. And I had to wait like a year or whatever for my second heart surgery.
Yeah, 14 months.
Yeah, 14 months. So I wasn't able to be, you know, an operator at all. I couldn't dive and jump, as you all know. But as my heart started healing up enough to where I could work out and the AFib wasn't, you know, too bad, I strapped on a ruck. So the day of my heart surgery, the day of it, I strapped on a 50-pound ruck, and I went out for a 10-mile run before my heart surgery. And on that run, I saw Hawk again. He's like, hey, man, aren't you supposed to be in heart surgery? I'm like, man, hey, look, dude, I know I'm going to be down for about 6 months, brother. I got to get every last bit of PT in. So that was just my mentality, and it rubbed guys the wrong way. You know what? And I don't blame them. If I had a guy like me that had, you know, I started discovering different levels of the mind, and I was excited to share that with people, but I didn't really know how to communicate it. So if you didn't do it, I was like, man, you're a punk. You ain't nobody. So now I have a better way of kind of get my message across without being angry at you because you're not doing what the hell I'm doing. So, but it was a great ride. I wouldn't change anything for the world. It taught me a lot about myself. It taught me a lot about not putting people and different organizations on such a high, high pedestal that it can hurt you like that. Like, I'll never forget, I met Michael Jordan when I was 12 years old. I met Michael Jordan, the great Michael Jordan, in his prime. And he was all over my wall. I met him when I was 12 years old, and I'll never forget me looking at Michael Jordan. I saw he was human. When I shook his hand, I saw he was just another human being. And I didn't look at Michael Jordan, you know, like the same way ever again. It was crazy.
Interesting. I mean, for people, civilians like me and people I know, to hear that a personality conflict kind of is limited your ascension in the teams and keeping like a really impressive person and soldier out of the you know, the fight, it seems almost like you're defeating yourself just because of a personality conflict. You're not putting your best assets out there. It just sounds strange. But I know it's easier to say from the outside looking in, but to me, it seems like it just shows you that systems and organizations are just made up of human beings, and human beings are super fallible, and that makes every organization fallible, and it just kind of limited you because of all that.
Well, see, one thing also, Adam, is this is a flashback. So as people know, I was in recruiting, and so I had done two platoons before, and then I went on to TRADET, which, you know, I was a land warfare instructor and also a CQC instructor, and then I went into recruiting. So when you do all this and then go into recruiting, that also hurt my career too. You know, a lot of guys are like, oh, you know, I work for the Admiral. I'm not in the platoon anymore. I'm out here, you know, going around running races and also doing, you know, speaking gigs and trying to recruit new SEALs. A lot of people just didn't understand that that was my job.
They also didn't know about the heart surgeries.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yeah. But you know, once again, I wasn't the kind of guy to explain to people all this stuff. And, you know, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. You know what? You don't like me. I like that.
Right.
I'm not going to sit and explain to you because by that time in my life, I really liked who I was. I liked who I was, and that was great for me.
And who you were and are is an unusual, uncommon motherfucker.
And I will wear that like a badge of honor.
Challenge number 9. This one's for the unusual motherfuckers in this world. A lot of people think that once they reach a certain level of status, respect, or success, that they've made it in life. I'm here to tell you that you always have to find more. Greatness is not something that if you meet it once, it stays with you forever. That shit evaporates like a flash of oil in a hot pan. If you truly want to become uncommon amongst uncommon, it will require sustaining greatness for a long period of time. It requires staying in constant pursuit and putting out unending effort. This may sound appealing, but will require everything you have to give and then some. Believe me, this is not for everyone, because it will demand singular focus and may upset the balance in your life. That's what it takes to become a true overachiever. And if you are already surrounded by people who are at the top of their game, what are you going to do differently to stand out? It's easy to stand out amongst everyday people and be a big fish in a small pond. It is a much more difficult task when you are a wolf surrounded by wolves. This means not only getting into Wharton Business School, but being ranked number 1 in your class. It means not just graduating buds, but becoming enlisted honor man in Army Ranger School, then going out and finishing Badwater. Torch the complacency you feel gathering around you, your coworkers, and teammates in that rare air. Continue to put obstacles in front of yourself, because that's where you'll find the friction that will help you grow even stronger. Before you know it, you will stand alone. Hashtag can't hurt me. Hashtag uncommon amongst uncommon.
That is a great chapter, and they can get a lot from that.
What do you mean by that challenge, though? You're kind of like leaving that one open-ended. This is kind of like almost
right.
Like a hidden message. It's for the people who are reading or listening, who are fucking listening while they're running 80 miles.
Right. You know what? This is for you. So, like, for me, man, I started dipping into a world that on the other end of suffering, I found a whole nother world. And it was a beautiful world. It was a world that, there was no limitations.
Mm.
There was no finish line. There was endless energy, endless power, endless strength. And I was like, my God, I mean, and it made me very polarizing to a lot of people. Like, either you really love me or really hate me. And in this world of trying to be uncommon amongst uncommon, you can really turn people off because a lot of people don't understand you, nor do they want to understand you because why? You're making them feel a certain way. You're making them feel bad about themselves. When you're constantly pushing and getting up earlier and getting up earlier and getting up earlier and fighting through pains and discomforts and you don't care about failure, you actually welcome it. That means you set the bar so high that it's like, oh, I failed. That's where I need to be. Now I got to figure it out. And people, it's like, hey, man, fuck you, man. I don't like being around you. You make me feel like an underachiever. Even though you're not trying to do that, you're just trying to find more of yourself. So that's why here it's really open to yourself to see where you want to go. Cause it's not about being David Goggins. It's not about being me. It's not about doing all these record attempts and going through all this training. That's what I wanted to do. You have to be uncommon amongst uncommon in your world, whatever that is. So that's why it's open-ended here. And it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody, because why? To be in this world, it takes everything. And then when you think you've given everything, you've just begun.
Hmm. There you go. So let's pull back a little bit. This is day four here in the Goggins capsule.
The Goggins podcast / radio show / audio book / this is good stuff, man.
It's the slash pod.
It is, man. I don't think anybody's ever done all the slashes that we're doing right now.
Well, it fits what you've done. You're like the ultimate slash man.
Yes. Yes. I have definitely become that guy.
Yeah, man. So day four, that last chapter, was recorded over 2 days because we run up against 6 and 7 hour, time limits in studio rentals. So just so you guys, since we're being so transparent. So yesterday we went up close to the limit and then felt it better to start again. So we kind of broke that up into 2 days, and now we're back in, midway in our day four.
And I'm loving the process, man.
But you are not loving Los Angeles traffic.
You know what? It is killing me. I'm so glad that I do not live here. I lived in San Diego for like 12 years, man. This traffic is killing me. Everybody just kind of like, it's just nuts.
It's nuts. I mean, in the city's defense, although it's tough to be in defense of Los Angeles traffic, a 4 p.m. meetup in the San Fernando Valley is not always the best time to be on our roads.
No. I mean, I'm leaving an hour and a half early.
Yeah.
Just in traffic, just cussing my ass off. I know Jennifer's like, oh my God.
You gotta get that on radio.
Oh, I know, right? You know, I think people probably think I cuss, you know, cuss way too much.
Do you get chastised for your sailor?
You know what?
Lexicon.
It's funny. There's some people who really hate it, but you know what? Once again, man, I'm very happy with who I am, and I'm not gonna try to tone myself down for people. If you don't like it, don't listen to me. And on top of that, I had a very hard, difficult life, and my life. So check it out, Adam. Let's say I explain my life of getting beat by my father. Hey, yeah, my dad really beat me. No, man, he beat the fuck out of me. You know what? Because that's exactly what happened. That's exactly how I felt at that time. So when I talk about it, it's not like I walk around all day long just dropping F-bombs and this and that. But when you bring me back to my life, I'm going to give you the raw, real life that I lived.
Well, the raw real is the power of what you have to say, I think. And it comes back to this theme I was talking about with somebody else today. It's just that, and we've talked about it on this recording, is that people don't want to hear things that are hard to hear.
No.
And that limits you. It limits you if you aren't willing to hear the hard to hear.
It's unbelievable, man. Like people, I put a post up and I post like once, you know, every Monday I'll post something on my social media site. And I try to go through every comment, man, because I want people to know if you're going to take the time to actually write a comment, I'm going to read it. I respond to a lot of them. Right now I can't because of the book and I'm so busy. But I read some comments and people are so upset that they have to write in about me saying, you know, an F or an S or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, oh my God, are you really that bothered? What did you get out of the daggone message?
Right.
Did you like the message?
No, they didn't hear it, man.
No, they didn't hear it because they're so worried about me saying fuck or shit. They're like, oh my God.
Nice is more important than good.
It really is. Right. And I'm sorry, man. That's just not the world we live in today.
It shouldn't be.
It's just not. Yeah.